Good afternoon. May it please the court, Bradley Levine, registration number 13095 on behalf of the plaintiff appellant. Your Honor, in the Smith versus Anderson case, which was written by Judge Roy, the court talked about in a misfeasance case such as this, in talking about a duty of care and going through the various factors that would enter into the question of whether or not there was a duty of care. Judge Roy wrote that the question of whether a duty should be imposed is essentially one of fairness under contemporary standards, as foreseeability includes what is likely enough in the setting of modern life that a reasonably thoughtful person would take it into account in guiding his or her practical conduct. And I would also point out in another case that was decided by this court, and Judge Plank, you joined this case. This was the Sewell versus Public Service Company case. This court said that, as in other cases, if differing factual inferences may be drawn from the evidence, the question of foreseeability remains a disputed factual issue, and the entry of summary judgment in such circumstances is improper. In this case,
excuse me, Counsel, Sewell, the one with the helicopter and the power line?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And so in this case, in the case before this court right now, the district court strayed from these precepts. What the court did is essentially usurped the role of a jury, the fact finder, who should have been the fact finder, and basically made what ultimately were factual determinations in the view of evidence that was presented to the trial court, which would lead to different factual inner inferences.
Saying that foreseeability can never be decided on summary judgment by a trial judge?
Well, Your Honor, it can be under certain circumstances, and that's what Sewell is talking about. It basically, Sewell stands for the proposition that if you look at the evidence and look at the facts, and based upon all those facts, that there aren't any inferences that can be drawn from them in favor of the non-moving party, yes, summary judgment is appropriate. But that's not the case in this situation.
Why isn't that the case here, then? What did the judge do wrong? I'm sure you're going to tell us.
I will tell you. Where the court here went wrong in the following steps. The court took a very narrow view of the circumstances here, basically focused its order on the question of whether or not Mr. Sosa, who's the person who was driving the vehicle at the time, whether or not Mr. Soski was familiar with this vehicle. And also took made some allusion to Mr. Soski's driving record and said that it was a relatively clean driving record. And that was basically where the trial court ended any kind of analysis here.
What I realized that Mr. Sosa was not the designated driver. There was an agreement. Another gentleman was supposed to be the driver. But what is there about Mr. Sosa which, if known by the dealership, would have made it a negligent or a violation of a duty to let him drive the car?
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate your question, but that really is not necessarily the question that needs to be asked, and that certainly wasn't the question that we were basing our claim of negligence on. It had to do with the facts and circumstances that were present here, and that's why what Your Honor said in the Smith case, that's why it becomes so important, is you look at all these the circumstances. What you have is Mr. Soski's there along with Mr. Ewing and then the third individual who was a 20-year-old. They come into the dealership, they indicate the fact that they have no intention on buying a vehicle that day. They indicate that they would like to try out what is essentially a sports car, which has some particular aspects to that car because of the titration
difficulty. If that's all they knew, is that foreseeable that there's going to be an accident? The young man come into the dealership, they say, we're not going to buy the car, we want to test drive it. Is that foreseeable there's going to be another? Not yet.
It's all the facts.
Okay, I'm waiting to see it.
And that's where I'm going with this. It's not just taking one particular fact and focusing in on it and saying, hey, because you know about that, then it's foreseeable that you're going to have an accident. It's the whole accumulation of the evidence, which is what we wanted to be able to present to a jury. And what you're talking about here
isn't duty a legal question and not a fact question?
Your Honor, and that's why Sewell becomes so important. You're talking about, again, you've got all these various factors. We've got the multifactorial analysis that we've been told by the Supreme Court we're supposed to do under Colorado law. And you're supposed to go through that. By the way, the district court didn't do that either, by the way. And the Jacques case makes it clear that it was incumbent upon the court to have gone through the various factors, and the court didn't do that. But in any event, the court focused on the foreseeability factor. And as far as the foreseeability factor, again, what this court said in the Sewell cases is that if you can draw different factual inferences, that that's something that should be presented to the jury for determination. Much the same as a proximate cause type of question or analysis, that ultimately that should be a question to go to the jury, unless you look at all the facts, as I said before, and you can only draw one inference, and that is that it was unforeseeable. And as I was saying, when we're looking at the various facts that were cogent here, we're talking about, again, a whole spectrum of things. We've got these three individuals who come in, they want to use this sports car. The standard, what Ralph Shomp's guidelines said, is that one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to have the salesperson who is going to get in the car and go on the test drive with the people who are going to be taking the vehicle out, and that happens about 88% of the time, that they go ahead and they accompany the driver. And had that happened, the injuries, this accident would never have occurred, and you know, my client would have been safe. So that's the first thing is that you either do that, you either have someone who's going to accompany you on the ride, or if you're unaccompanied, the standard guideline at Ralph Shomp is that you had to go on a designated route. That never happened. What happened here is that the salesperson never told these folks what that designated route consisted of. And the importance of that designated route is that it promotes safety. What you're basically doing is taking a car with which you're unfamiliar, you're making all right turns in a very limited area. And they would never have gone out onto E470, they never would have gone up, they never would have been making a left turn into a crowded intersection where Mr. Sosa was unfamiliar with the operation of that vehicle, and that's what led to this incident.
That's my next question. I can't find anywhere in the briefs where there's any connection between his alleged unfamiliarity with the transmission or clutch or both and the accident.
Well, Your Honor, and I will tell you, and again, that's something which there was questions. There was deposition questions that were asked of Mr. Ewing, and then eventually of Mr. Sosa about what it is that happened. And as best we can tell, he was in this intersection, he was making a left-hand turn, and he basically the car stalled there. In other words, it was sitting in this intersection at the time that the light turned red, and our clients who were riding on a motorcycle coming eastbound on Conrad County Line Road rammed into his vehicle.
They didn't ram into him. They rammed into him. They rammed into them.
Yeah,
stopped in front of them.
He's right. They were stopped right in front of them.
Through a red light.
Right, in a red light, right in the middle of the intersection. And as best we can tell, and that was the question, is whether or not he doesn't know why it happened. Either because it stalled, it's because something happened when he was jumping the gears. We had evidence that we were going to present to the jury if we'd had the opportunity, to the effect that he thought he had it in first gear, and instead he jammed it up into third gear because you had a very small area for the gear shift. These were the multitude of possibilities, but what we do know is that he would not have been in that intersection if Ralph Shomp had done exactly what it is that they had in place, the kinds of protocol that they had in place in order to protect the safety of the driving public, including...
Now let me understand what you're saying. You're saying he made a left-hand turn and stalled in the oncoming lane.
Yes.
The light turned red.
Yes.
And your client ran the red light and hit him.
No. I'm sorry. He was, I apologize, but my client was coming into the lane at the same time that he was turning left, okay? In other words, he was turning left and was supposed to be going through there, okay, going through the intersection, and he didn't clear the intersection before they hit the side of the car.
I'm still having a hard time visualizing, but I'll let Judge Richmond explain it to me later.
So in any event, but the point here is that these are all facts and circumstances. So in response to your question, Judge Roy, we're not talking about just simply one question of whether or not they knew that he was going to be getting behind the car, although that's, again, another circumstance. The fact of the matter is that what they've all agreed is that if they had been told about this designated route, that they would have stuck to that designated route. out. All of the folks who were driving the car.
Under your theory, it doesn't really matter who was driving the car or the qualifications of the driver. If Mr. Ewing had been driving the car, you would still say there was negligence.
That could absolutely be. That's absolutely right.
So it had nothing to do with his driving record, his familiarity with the clutch, or anything like that. You're just saying...
Well, in terms of familiarity with the clutch, that does matter. I mean, the question here is that what they didn't say, what the evidence was, is that they, each one of them, certainly Mr. Sosa said that he was not told that he couldn't drive the car. Okay, so that if that's the case, if they were going to restrict the drivers, it was incumbent upon the salesperson to tell them, you know, this is the only Mr.
Didn't Ewing sign the piece of paper that said, I will not turn this car over
that's
to somebody else.
That's exactly right.
He violated it.
But the fact is,
how's a dealership supposed to know? Are they supposed to anticipate that he's going to violate his own written agreement that I won't turn the car over to somebody else?
The fact is that that's not the only fact that we have here. If we're going to focus on that one fact, under these kinds of circumstances, they need to tell somebody. In other words, what they do is they brought Mr. Ewing into the dealership and had him sign that. Mr. Gianti, the salesperson, never says to the other occupants, you cannot drive this car. Only Mr. Ewing can drive this car. So they had absolutely no idea that they couldn't do it.
They indicated to Mr. Gianti that they intended to drive the car?
Had they told them that all three of us can drive this car?
No,
they didn't do that. They didn't do that. But the point is that, yes, if it was Mr. Ewing who was driving the car, in terms of familiarity, they did absolutely nothing. The salesperson did absolutely nothing to check to make sure that even Mr. Ewing understood this is a sports car, that he understood the nature of this particular car, and checked to make sure that they were familiar with the various aspects of this car. So yes, if it was Mr. Ewing, they never told anybody who was going to potentially be driving that car about the route that they needed to take, which was there for safety reasons.
I don't know if it meets the test of foreseeability, but I suppose there's a modicum of foreseeability that if I gave you the keys to my car right now, have you drive it somewhere, you would have an accident. There's some foreseeability there. Is there any foreseeability above that here?
Absolutely. What you have here, the foreseeability is the circumstances, again, the whole set of circumstances. It's not you giving me your car, you're walking into a dealership. The dealership knows that they are giving people cars with which they are not familiar. What they are doing is that they have a responsibility that they've undertaken by saying, look, we are either going to have one of our salespeople in that vehicle with the driver. If not, we are going to give them a designated route. In this case, the company did neither one of those things, which are there to ensure the safety both of the occupants of the vehicle as well as the safety of the driving public.
How would the presence of the salesman prevented this accident?
Because the salesperson would have told these folks to drive on their designated route, plus they wouldn't have been able, it would only be Mr. Ewing who had been driving that car, and presumably he would have checked to make sure that Mr. Ewing had the sufficient familiarity with the vehicle and so on. But the most important thing is that he would have ensured that they were driving on a route that was going to be a safe route, as opposed to going out on E-470, coming back, being in an area and taking maneuvers that would not be a safe maneuver.
The designated route was for unaccompanied drivers, right?
It's a prescribed route for people who don't have somebody else in the vehicle.
Four right turns.
That's exactly right, the four right turns. On the other hand, he would have been there to make sure that the route that they were taking is not one which you should be taking in a car which has got the kinds of potentially dangerous proclivities if you don't know how to operate that type of vehicle. I've got 1 minute left. I'd like to reserve for rebuttal if I can, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Opposing counsel. My name is Richard Waltz, 11567. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Appellee. As Judge Roy wrote in his decision, involving...
You're quoting me a lot lately.
Smith versus Anderson. I think that's because of what we're doing in preparation, to be honest, Your Honor. We both saw that you were on here. And we also knew Judge Plank was on the scene. But you did say...
I'm just the innocent bystander.
Let me look at your name, Judge Richmond. I'm just
keeping a low profile for years, you know.
And so it's not to take out of context your quote. What you did say was, no one factor in determining whether to recognize a duty in Ms. Feasen's case is controlling. And then in Smith versus Anderson, there was a discussion of the difference between misfeasance and nonfeasance, what causes that, et cetera. I would suggest to the court this. This case started out, as you could tell from the pleadings, where the injured party was a passenger on a motorcycle operated by her husband. There was a collision. The motorcycle actually struck the vehicle operated by Mr. Soski. He was making a left turn. This disputed issue of fact as to what caused them to collide. Ms. Brannigan then sued her husband, sued Mr. Soski, sued Mr. Ewing, and sued my client. She settled with the other three, leaving my client. The Supreme Court in its 4-3 decision in case bill, I think, really is instructive of what we're talking about from a duty standpoint here. The Supreme Court, in its decision, adopted the concept of negligent entrustment. And it said, what are the factors that go into a negligent entrustment? But one of the telling things about the court in its decision, and now I read from page 359, they cite illustration 7. In illustration 7, under the restatement 390, which is what governs negligent entrustment, says, if a person makes a business of renting out boats for hire, and then it goes on to say, and they give it to somebody who's intoxicated, they knew or they reasonably should know that there's some danger attendant to that. And why is that important? Because in the restatement, both 308, which talks about negligence, and 390, which talks about negligent entrustment, they say this: if the actor knows or should know that a person intends or is likely to use a thing to conduct himself in the activity in a manner to create an unreasonable risk of harm, not risk of harm, because as Judge Ray pointed out in argument, it's a risk of harm every time you get in a motor vehicle. They then say in 390, we're talking about negligent entrustment. If my client, who supplies a chattel, in this case a vehicle to someone to use, has reason to know or reason to believe that the person to whom they give it, because of their youth, inexperience, or otherwise, would use it in a manner involving an unreasonable risk of harm, they could be found liable.
Is there any evidence here that the dealership knew, assuming Soski had a bad driving record, or it wasn't that, it was that he had no experience, was there any evidence that they knew about his driving limitations whatsoever?
None.
Was there any evidence that they knew that he intended to drive the car or that they planned to turn it over to him?
There's none on the record. But I would advise the court of this. What's interesting about this case is they contracted with Ewing to drive the car. Ewing takes the car with his three friends. They take it out, and it's not like they went out on a joyride. They went out to C-470. They went from Broadway to University. They drove it around, they changed drivers. The man driving, that had a better driving record than Ewing, had more insurance than Ewing. It became a windfall in a sense for coverage. But I digress. Soski had a better driving record than Ewing. Not to say that Ewing had a bad driving record. The record's clear that what Soski had was 2 moving violations in his career, and of those, they were both pled down to non-moving violations. And he'd never had an accident before.
The dealership had no reason to think he was going to drive. So I guess I don't understand the relevance of these facts at all.
I'm not suggesting it is. I'm trying to counter the arguments made by the plaintiff appellant in this case. I would also point out to the court, because a question's been asked about this unfamiliarity with the vehicle and this intersection. This is intersection. The intersections involved in this case, to do right turns, are Broadway Bellevue, University Bellevue, University County Line, and you come around. You're talking about busy intersections that you're going to drive on. But most importantly, what we're talking about here is that there's nothing unreasonable about the risk we're talking about here from a negligent entrustment or negligent standpoint. And when you're talking about foreseeability, I'll present this to the court, because this is where this argument comes down. We all know that under the facts of this case, they signed a contract. He gave it to his buddy drove it. But that's not what dealerships do. They're asking the court, this court, to find a duty for dealerships under circumstances where people operate their vehicles. And I'd suggest to the court, looking at the different factors taken into account duty, fairness under contemporary standards. Where are we today in our society? We're talking about dealerships. Who sell motorcycles, bicycles, scooters, vehicles? They rent vehicles. Today, the policy of almost every major dealership in Colorado is you take your car in for repair, they'll give you a loaner. They give you a loaner, they'll allow you to take it home. They actually leave the jurisdiction.
But there is some suggestion here that your client had some level of foreseeability of danger, because they developed a prescribed route, according to the plaintiffs, and they wanted them to go on a route where they just did, I think Judge Plank said, four right turns. I guess that gets back where we started. So they must have had some clue that going off that route might have some higher level of foreseeability of the risk than Judge Roy was talking about.
I would agree with the court that you could draw that conclusion, and the record reflects that there were other factors. One, they don't want people driving their vehicles all over. They want them to come back in a reasonable period of time. It's not a, quote, safety rule, end quote. I mean, we're talking about this with some case law cited, such as, for example, when you fly your airplane and you're going to have colored balls. There's a reason why they do that. Statistically, what you find is that there are far more accidents when they're unmarked than they are. In this particular case, we don't have any standard in the industry. We don't say, well, everybody turns right. And I got to tell you, Your Honor, the statistics in this case says that not everybody turns right, not everybody is guided by that. And
everybody turns right more safely than they turn left, I guess, is the more important issue. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I guess unless you're a pedestrian who happens to be crossing the street and you're turning right. And then we'll get into the foreseeability there. That's really what we're talking about here. Is it foreseeable when you're on the street that there can be an accident? It's not foreseeable if you sign a contract with one person who gives it to another. We're becoming very Paul's Gravian. And I know this is not about proximate cause. This is about foreseeability. It is about duty and whether we want to enforce a duty. Social utility is one of the factors you take into account with a duty under the case law that's developed here. Should you be able to take your car home to somebody to look at it? Should you be able to take it home to your mechanic? And should you be able to take it on C-470 for a spin to see if it has the bump that they claim it's not? With all due respect, it's a Honda. This is a Honda Civic.
Evidence in the record that it's more foreseeable that if the salesman doesn't go along on the test drive with two people in the car, one may give it to the other contrary to that contract? Was there any evidence to that respect?
I'm going to say that there's no evidence of that. I don't believe there is. I attended all the depositions. I don't think there's any evidence of that. You know, what happens, I think, frankly, speaking to the court, which I should always do, more likely than not, when they came in and they said they wanted to just test drive it, he was going to allow them to do it, maybe to entice them later on to buy it. But for the fourth man to squeeze into a Honda Civic, he said, why don't you go ahead and take it? And that's not a standard.
Plus, they've already announced they're not going to buy it. Salesman might better spend his time elsewhere.
Well, I don't know if that should keep you from having a duty to the general public, but under the facts of this case, I don't think that means that they're negligent by not going in the car with them, nor should it. By the way, the salesman was huge, and he would have been in the back seat or the front seat. And of course, as they point out to court, there's two things. One, if you're with the salesman, you can go anywhere you want. If you're without the salesman, they prefer you go in the right turns. So if my client salesman had been in that vehicle on the day of the accident, they'd have been very as speculative as anything else at that intersection, turning left, and we'd have another injured party. Because there's no evidence in this case. There's nothing in this record to suggest that anything about that vehicle caused this accident, other than he didn't see the motorcyclist. That's all we have for the accident. So the next thing I'm dealing with foreseeability this court is to take into consideration, and this court decides it anew, it's not bound by what the trial court found, is the magnitude of the burden on the industry. And we're talking again about the automotive industry and the different ways by which they allow people with valid driver's licenses, insurance, and they're employed. I mean, we're talking about men in their mid-20s on a Honda Civic. Why could they not give it to them to drive? Why should they not be able to give it to them to drive? So the magnitude of the burden would be, I'll tell you what the court, what the plaintiff has asked this court to do. It's in a reply brief. First, they concede that they're social utility to test driving. That's at page 15 of their reply brief. They then say that they would like this court to adopt as a standard a designated route, thereby dictating how one should sell cars. Next, they argue, at pages 15 to 16, the dealership should instruct the test driver of the designated route. They should check the inform the person of the unusual aspects of the test drive vehicle. I suggest to the court that every time somebody's test driving a new car, there's going to be unusual aspects. I mean, that's the whole idea of buying a new car.
Unless familiar aspects.
So, unfamiliar. I'm not sure. One can argue that hiding the button to get into the gas tank could be a problem because we can't find those. And then the last thing they ask this court to do is, quote, properly qualify test drivers to minimize risky behavior and a motor vehicle accident resulting from operating vehicles with which they are less than optimally familiar. Seriously, the courts in this state should start dictating the length to which a dealership is to interview somebody about operating a car. For example, they look at your driver's license, they see you have on there, you should wear glasses. Well, we had them checked recently, and I'm not being facetious when I say that. What are the lengths to which one should check into someone's ability to operate a motor vehicle, except to see if, one, you have a valid Colorado driver's license, and two, you have insurance as required in the Colorado law. And third, that when you appear before them, you're not a dangerous risk, such as intoxicated when we're giving you the boat. And beyond that, I would suggest at this point that, well, I don't like using that phrase, slippery slope, but when you're talking about, you really are talking about the slippery slope where the entire industry, whether you rent vehicles or whether you sell vehicles, anything that can be used, equipment. Are we really getting to now where if you rent equipment, such as chainsaws or wood chippers, you don't have to start delving into the ability of the person to use it? Because that's what they're suggesting, when you have no reason to believe that person's not competent to do that. And I'll finish by saying Mr. Soski was competent. Everything about the record here says he was competent to do this. So given the facts and given the arguments by the parties in this case, we would ask that you affirm the summary judgment granted by the trial court. Thank you so much. If there's any other questions, but thank you.
They left us with a couple of minutes. You have 1 minute, as I recall.
That's right.
You haven't addressed negligent entrustment, which quite frankly seems to me to be your best argument. Okay? What do you want to tell us in the time you have left about negligent entrustment?
Well, Your Honor, it's basically this. Number one is that I would advise the court, I think that the Whiteside case that was decided way back in 1951 involves very similar circumstances, even though at that point we didn't have the Casebolt case, so we didn't have the articulation, if you will, of the notion of negligent entrustment. What we have here is a circumstance where, based upon the facts, and I'm not going to tell the court that they knew that they were going to be taking this car and all these things were going to be happening, that they were going to be going on the route that they did. But it's a question not only of what you knew, but what you should have known based upon the facts and circumstances. And I would urge the court to, if you look at the Casebolt case, it indicates that when you're talking about negligent entrustment, it's just basically, if you will, a subset of a theory of negligence. And so you need to look at the same kinds of factors. And the question here of whether or not, under these circumstances, based upon all the information that they had, and by the way, Your Honor, there was evidence in the record to the effect, first of all, they walked in and said, we're going to be doing this. And number two is the question of whether or not there's evidence that under these kinds of circumstances that you would have a change in drivers. That's something which our expert witness, who's got a lot of experience in this area, Mr. Stivers, in his affidavit, addresses that precise issue. So the upshot, Your Honor, is that we think that as far as any kind of negligent entrustment, that the facts and circumstances are such that at the very least, it should be up to a jury to sort out this evidence, these various facts, and decide whether or not, in the circumstances, under appropriate instructions from the court, whether or not there was some type of knowledge or sufficient knowledge that they had based upon the facts and circumstances and what it is that
we had that Shaw knows about and that they had this whole safety regimen in place for, whether or not they were negligent under the circumstances in trusting this vehicle to these group of people without having some protections in place, such as having either the manager who was there accompanying them, if not, telling what the prescribed route was going to be. And because, again, the evidence, and they all acknowledged, if they had been told that that was the prescribed route, if that's what they were supposed to do, they would have abided by it. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both counsel for the briefs and argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.